is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kenkin for Jane Lindholm. For those of you who get your drinking water from Lake Champlain and those of you who like to play in the lake, the elevated algae levels are probably on your radar. Cleaning up the lake and reducing those toxic algae blooms has become a priority. Under Vermont's 2015 Clean Water Act, the state hopes to minimize polluting runoff, specifically phosphorus runoff, that has been shown to promote harmful algae blooms. The new rules and regulations are in various phases of development, and today we'll talk about what kind of impact they may have on the lake's future and what kind of shape the lake is in right now. We'll also talk about what scientists know and what they don't know when it comes to algae blooms and how big a risk they may pose. I'm joined in the studio by Mike Winslow. He's staff scientist at the Lake Champlain Committee. That's a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Lake Champlain's health and accessibility. Mike, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me, Nina.
So if you were going to give Lake Champlain a letter grade, and that might obviously be oversimplifying things a little bit, but if you were going to give it a letter grade for water quality right now, what would that be?
You're right. That's very much oversimplifying it. The Lake Champlain isn't one entity. There are five different segments, and they have different degrees of water quality. So somewhere like Missisquoi Bay or St. Albans Bay right now might get a C, whereas the main lake would probably get an A.
So when people hear about elevated levels of cyanobacteria, otherwise known as the blue-green algae, in various parts of the lake, as you mentioned, there are different levels. And swimmers are warned to stay away or keep their pets out of the water. Is that the main reason that you might, you know, grade some parts of the lake is more problematic than others? Or are there other things going on in the lake that are causing problems as well?
That is certainly the main reason that would come to my mind. We don't have major issues with toxic pollutants. We don't have other issues that we think of that would be causing harm to people. It's really the cyanobacteria that would be causing the most harm.
And let's remind listeners what blue-green algae or cyanobacteria is.
Okay. So these are photosynthetic organisms. They make their food from the sunlight. They're basically tiny, tiny plants. But the blue-green algae in particular differ from other algae because they have a much more primitive cell structure. And so that's the difference between the bacteria and algae. And there's debates about that in academic circles, which terms to use. But they're basically living organisms. They're native to the environment here. They've always been around. Under certain conditions, they proliferate and grow, and you can have huge blooms of them. Sometimes these blooms produce toxins. An EPA study recently looking at blooms around the country said that about half of them produce toxins at all.
And for people that are walking by the lake and they're seeing stuff floating in the water, I want to talk a little bit more specifically about what the blue-green algae looks like versus
okay.
what other stuff that you might see in the lake looks like. So describe, you know, what does it look and smell like, for instance?
Under the worst conditions, it looks like a paint spill on the water,
huh.
A green to yellow or a green paint spill. Sometimes as the cells break down, it'll turn to a turquoise, very bright blue. When we're training people to look for blue-green algae and distinguish it from other things, we give them a couple clues because there are a lot of other plants that are out there that don't produce toxins. So we tell them if you took a stick and tried to pick this stuff up, you wouldn't be able to do it. The individual particles are microscopic. If you pick up something and there's stringy things hanging off of it, it's not the blue-green algae we're worried about producing toxins.
I've heard it described as like a pea soup.
Yes, very much so, depending on how thick it can be. It also can be just a few green flecks in the water at very low densities. Now, at those low densities, we don't expect to have high toxin concentrations. Then it's just unsightly, and you're worried about it becoming thicker.
Well, I saw on the Vermont Health Department website, they've got photos of what is and is not blue-green algae,
yes.
Which I found very helpful. And listeners, you may want to check those photos out because you can kind of see they have them right side by side. I'm like, oh. So it's not just, you know, some sludgy stuff that you might see necessarily floating in the water.
And one of the things we've had this year is that there are really large mats of non-toxic green algae. Because the water levels are so low, they're growing very well. But these are the things that you can pick up with a stick and they're hanging off and it's not the toxin-producing stuff. So it may be unsightly. It may make you not want to swim there, but it's not a health issue.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about water quality of Lake Champlain, the potentially harmful cyanobacteria. That's that blue-green algae that we've just been talking about. What makes that potentially toxic and how do you identify it? If you have questions, questions, you can call us at 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your water quality questions on our Facebook page or at Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Mike Winslow of the Lake Champlain Committee is my guest today. And I'm curious, you know, you mentioned that some of this blue-green algae is toxic and some is not. I want to talk about when it is toxic, what kind of a health risk are we talking about?
The main risk with the toxic algae is ingesting it. If you swallow a lot of it, you get some stomach distress, diarrhea, gastrointestinal distress, potentially vomiting. If you inhale a lot of the stuff in the air, then it's kind of like allergies, runny eyes, runny nose, sore throat. They can produce substances on their skin that might make you itch, but those aren't necessarily toxin related, and simply showering will take care of that issue. So the main threat that we worry about is gastrointestinal distress caused by ingesting the algae.
And is that why often you hear people that are very worried if their dogs are swimming or playing in the water, because dogs typically are, you know, ingesting a lot of the water, or, you know, chewing on sticks that have been floating in the water, that sort of thing?
Dogs will swim places that people would naturally avoid. They will drink a lot of water while swimming. They'll lick their fur when they get out of the water and get a second dose that way. And they have a smaller body size. So those features sort of combine to make them more vulnerable.
And do scientists understand why some algae is toxic and some of the green-blue algae is not?
Absolutely not. There are a lot of questions about that. We know the scientists have been able to isolate the genes that produce certain toxins. So you can go into a population of blue-green algae and say whether that gene is present or not. And within a species, there can be variation about whether that gene is present or not. And then we don't know when the algae try to turn that gene on, what triggers that to happen. What we think of as a toxin may not be to them. It's not necessarily something that's trying to keep predators away. There's some evidence that it might be protecting them from sunlight. So only when you get a large mass of algae do they start to produce the toxins, because they're trying to protect one another from sunlight. It may be a cue to each other to stop reproducing because there's a lot of us already. There's a lot of questions there that we just don't know the answers to.
And are there things in the lake that eat the blue-green algae?
Absolutely. And one of the things we see is if you have a lot of plant matter around, sometimes the plants can harbor predators for the algae and the blooms never really get a chance to take off. But if you have areas where there isn't that plant matter, where you don't have those what I would call zooplankton able to leave the leaves and eat the developing bloom, then that's when blooms are more likely to occur.
Mike, there's a recent study that showed a possible connection between elements of blue-green algae and some forms of dementia, Parkinson's. I think ALS was also linked in the study. It was pretty disturbing. Can you talk about that study and what researchers found?
I would call that study, that whole body of research, fairly weak. There are a lot of big questions that still need to be answered. And there's a lot of debate about how to even isolate the chemical that they're looking at in causing this issue. The substance in question is BMAA. It's a non-essential amino acid. And depending on which paper you read, either all blue-green algae produce it or only just a very few of them. And that's a big issue, because if it's only a few of them, the species that the group that we know produces it, we've never seen in Lake Champlain. The other paper that says lots of different types produce it, well, if it's that ubiquitous and Alzheimer's is still, or ALS is still fairly rare, then there's a big disconnect between exposure and actual onset of symptoms. There's a lot of other factors that are going on there that we don't fully understand. Some of the research that's coming out of Wyoming is really trying to get into the physiology of how this might work, and is largely being targeted in order to develop cures or treatments for ALS. And I think that that's really productive. Some of the epidemiology that's going on around it, though, is I have less faith in.
Listeners, we talked more in depth about this particular study on a Vermont Edition program back in January. And if you're interested in hearing more, we've got a link to that show on our program page at vpr.net, so you can go back and listen it more in depth. You know, I'm curious, you know, we're talking about these algae blooms that are going on in various parts of Lake Champlain, but what other waterways in the state are seeing this? Are you familiar with, you know, is this something that's happening in, say, Lake Bombazine or Lake St. Catherine or other lakes and waterways across the state?
We have had reports this year of blooms in Chittenden Reservoir down in Rutland County. And a pond in the southern part of the state maintained by the Corps of Engineers whose name I can't remember offhand, Stratton or something along those lines. Historically, we have seen blooms on Lake Iroquois. I believe there was one on Lake Elmore a number of years ago. There's a pond in the Northeast Kingdom, Tickle Naked Pond, which has a history of problems with algae blooms. Lake Memphremagog has had them in the past. But the combination of blooms near centers of population tends to be most prevalent on Lake Champlain.
Well, you talked about Chittenden Reservoir, and that's in my backyard, basically. I swim and kayak on that reservoir a lot. But, you know, I'm thinking there aren't many farms in that area as far as runoff goes. So that sort of surprises me.
Blue-green algae are a natural part of the ecosystem. They are in every water. It's just that when are conditions right for these blooms? And one thing that may be happening, that we're seeing blooms increasing around the world, not just in Vermont, and I suspect it's largely because of changes in temperature. We know our water temperatures are increasing. And what that does is that the algae have an optimum growth temperature, and if it reaches that earlier in the season, then they can start blooming earlier and going on later.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about water quality issues in the state of Vermont, specifically looking at Lake Champlain, where potentially harmful blue-green algae blooms have been occurring. Maybe they've made it so you couldn't go swimming, or maybe they've made it so you've kept your pets out of the water. If you have a question about blue-green algae and water quality in general, you can call us at 1-800-639-2211 or post your water quality questions on our Facebook page. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to the phone lines now to Swanton and take a call from Alan. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. This is a very interesting topic, seeing how I live on the lake. When Mike gives the grade for Missisquoi Bay and for St. Albans Bay a C, well, in my day, a C was average. And I will tell you what, it is far, far, far of anything I've ever seen. The poorest water quality for public swimming, for public recreation. It is incredible. I was in St. Albans Bay last year, took a ride down to the bay by boat, and if you put your hand in that water 3 inches, you could not see your fingers. And that is not average. I don't know if you're trying to paint a much more pleasant picture than it is, but it is disgusting.
Alan, was it
the algae dies, it washes up on shore, it smells so bad you have to close your windows. That's the condition of the lake.
All
and
right.
It's the phosphorus from the farmers.
Alan, we've got it. Let me throw that to my guest, Mike Winslow.
Nina asked a very specific question, which was, what is it like today? And it changes rapidly. And I agree completely with Alan that an overall grade would be a D or an F. Yeah. Missisquoi Bay and St. Albans Bay have the most challenging water quality conditions in the lake, probably in the state. But today, it's not necessarily that bad. One of the things that's happened today, this year, that's been a real surprise is that the blooms have not yet developed in St. Albans and Missisquoi Bay. It's a little bit late for them to be developing, but not unheard of. And we still have a bit of summer left, so I wouldn't be surprised if they start developing. We began to hear reports yesterday and today of blooms just beginning in parts of those two areas. But it's a little bit late this year. So when I answered that question, I was answering specifically for today. But overall, I completely agree with the caller.
And does that have to do with the fact that there's been less runoff and less snow melt, do you think, the fact that we're seeing blooms later? Any connection?
When I was asked at the beginning of the season what was it going to be like, I hedged my bets. I have reasons to think it would be worse this year and reasons to think it would be better. The reason I think it would be worse is we have low water levels and it's much warmer, and that warmth does trigger blooms. But we didn't have any snow. We had very little melt, very little spring runoff, so we didn't have an influx of a lot of phosphorus early in the season. Researchers out in Lake Erie are looking at trying to predict where blooms occur, when seasons are going to be bad, and they find that there's a six-week lag time between the highest loading of a certain type of phosphorus and when the blooms develop. And when we didn't have that loading this year, it could be helping the situation. But again, the temperature is going to matter, and conditions are changing even as we speak.
Interesting. And Alan talked about you know, just the fact that the water looks different. It's not clear. Are there other things in the lake that are making it cloudy, or is that all just the blue-green algae?
Missisquoi Bay has gotten more cloudy through the years, probably as a result of blue-green algae and sediment runoff from various factors in the watershed. That's different from the rest of the lake. Most of the rest of the lake has actually gotten clearer since the 1980s. And that's probably due to the arrival of zebra mussels. Zebra mussels filter the water. They take the particles out of the water. And so we've had measurable increases in water clarity. One would think that that's a good thing, but there is a downside of it. When the water is clear, that means sunlight reaches farther to the bottom and plants can grow more prolifically and in more places than they had prior.
Our caller was talking about farm runoff, so I want to talk about some of the new regulations that are targeting that and that hopefully will impact some of this blue-green algae that we're seeing. Because most of the phosphorus runoff does come from agriculture, not all, as you've said, but about 65%, farmers will be feeling the new clean water regulations most keenly. So I'm wondering, can you talk just briefly about some of the changes they'll need to make to comply with the new Clean Water Act?
Well, one of the big things is that small farms now have to certify that they are following required agricultural practices. I have argued and would argue that the agricultural practices, acceptable agricultural practices that we had prior to the clean water rule that just passed, applied to all farmers, but the state didn't feel the same way. And so now with the legislative change, all farmers will be expected to follow the required agricultural practices. That means leaving certain buffers from their lands. That means balancing the nutrients that are going onto their fields with those coming off of their fields, and various other strategies to deal with soil health. The RAPs, the AAPs are sort of the bare minimum that any good business should be doing in order to protect the resources of the state.
Mary writes in, we have had numerous studies and forums on this problem for the past 20 years. What has been lacking in enforcement of existing regulations? And is it true that the main obstacle to real action is the lack of cooperation of the landowners? The tragedy of the commons seems to be at work here, with those of us who use the lake refusing to take responsibility for acting in the common good.
There's an assumption in that question that the situation is going to change. And I'm not sure I accept that assumption. I look at St. Albans Bay in particular. In the 1980s, we dropped phosphorus loading to Missisquoi Bay, or St. Albans Bay, by 70%. The phosphorus levels in the bay did not change. The system is very resilient. Phosphorus builds up in the sediment, and when temperatures and oxygen levels in the water reach a certain point, it can be released from the sediment and maintain the status quo. What we're really trying to do with the new regulations is prevent it from getting worse. We have seen it get worse in Missisquoi Bay since about the 1960s or 70s. I don't know that we can turn that around.
Well, that's kind of disturbing what you're saying, the fact that, you know, we're enacting these restrictions on some farmers, we're trying to take measures, but you're saying right now that you're not very optimistic that it'll make things better. It'll just hold off things from getting worse.
That is my position.
Huh. 1-800-639-2211, our number to call if you have a question about Lake Champlain, water quality in general. Let's go to the phones now and take a call from Rutland. Julia is on the line. Hi, Julia. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I live here in Rutland. I go kayaking on Chittenden Reservoir from time to time. I was very interested in two comments that were made that Chittenden Reservoir is seeing these algae blooms, and you know, there's really no agricultural runoff as far as I can see emptying into that reservoir. And the other comment was made about a small pond up north, I forget which one it was, that had them several years ago, as you, someone said, and no longer has them. And the bottom line to me, the worrisome thing is that the farmers basically are being, you know, penalized heavily for and blamed for causing this problem, which A, seems to have no resolution in terms of eliminating the algae, and B, the algae seems to be appearing in places which don't get farm runoff. So I wonder if you can speak to that.
Thanks for the call, Julia. She's kind of sounds like, Mike, that she's wondering about the fact that we're seeing algae blooms in areas without farms. And you sort of addressed that issue a few minutes ago. And that maybe do you feel that farmers are being unfairly blamed for the problem?
I have mixed feelings about that. I think that many farmers have taken a lot of really strong strides in order to try to improve the way they're doing things, and I don't think those strides are widely enough recognized. At the same time, I think there is a contingent that are very recalcitrant, that aren't willing to take those steps, and they need to be called out not just by the state as a whole, but by other farmers. And I feel like one of the issues in the new law is that you can lose current use tax funding if you don't follow the required agricultural practices, if you're an egregious violator of what is considered acceptable farm practices. The Farm Bureau fought that, and I was a little bit disappointed by that because I really think those farmers that aren't doing their job need to be called out. And it's not the majority. It's not all of them, but we can't ignore them.
We'll take more of your calls and questions about water quality in the state, and we'll talk about a new law that went into effect last month aimed at ensuring people get faster public health information about blue-green algae blooms. Just a reminder, our number, if you'd like to take part in the conversation, is 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and we're talking about water quality of Lake Champlain with Mike Winslow. He's staff scientist at the Lake Champlain Committee. That's a nonprofit dedicated to protecting Lake Champlain's health and accessibility. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you today. Are you noticing more algae in Lake Champlain? Has it kept you from swimming or allowing your family or pets to swim? Do you think the new cleanup efforts the state is taking are enough? 1-800-639-2211 is our number, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So a new law went into effect July 1st that mandates that the public be informed of algae blooms on the lake within an hour, and that the state's Department of Health will maintain an internet site dedicated to informing the public of the presence of cyanobacteria or blue-green algae. Mike, talk about how this law works and whether you think it will help.
Well, one thing to point out is the law requires that the public be notified if there is a public health hazard.
Oh, all right.
Not all algae blooms present a public health hazard. So there is some leeway, and the definition of public health hazard is affected by how many people are affected, how severe the impacts, and there's a lot of discretion from the Department of Health.
But you were just saying before in the program that you don't always know when blue-green algae is toxic or not. So how do you know
exactly.
that?
Exactly. So what the Department of Health has done is taken a very proactive approach, and they do their best to warn people whenever a bloom is identified and known. We do that. We have a four-part monitoring system for Lake Champlain. The vast majority of it is a network of volunteers trained by the Lake Champlain Committee, and we communicate with them regularly. There's over 100 sites around the lake that report every week where the volunteers go out and observe the water conditions, and they just do a visual observation of whether algae are there or not. The second piece of that is a subset of these volunteers go out and actually collect water samples, and that allows us to make sure that when they're seeing no blooms, and there are also no toxins there. So we've not had a situation where we've got levels of concern of toxins in the absence of blooms. And the third piece is that the Department of Health or that the Department of Environmental Conservation goes out every 2 weeks to mid-lake locations within each of the lake segments and does a thorough analysis of the species there, toxins present or absence, and the visual monitoring. And then the fourth piece is drinking water monitoring. Every week, the public drinking water supplies on Lake Champlain sample their inputs, the water coming in, and that is analyzed for toxins.
Matt in Georgia wrote us an email. He said, according to the Vermont Department of Health's interactive blue-green algae interactive tracking map, there is a likely bloom at Georgia Bay Beach today, or Georgia Beach today. It was first noticed on August 15th. Where the supposed current bloom appears is public property, a beach access area owned by the town of Georgia. But as of this morning, he writes, the town hasn't heard a word from the Department of Health, not a peep. And as of this morning, the town is on its own trying to figure out if we should put up a no swimming poster or close the beach. And Matt writes, doesn't it seem the Department of Health could be more proactive in its outreach? Why don't they step up their communication efforts? And I should say that he wrote us a follow-up email a little while later saying it appears the water is clean now, and I'd expect the warning will be lifted. So I guess Matt's question is...
Matt's premises are wrong. The town of Georgia was informed of this bloom. I contacted the town administrator. I submitted that observation to the Department of Health tracker and contacted the town health administrator before submitting that observation. The observation was put in yesterday when we received notice of the bloom, and it was taken down this morning because the bloom had disappeared. And I've been in communication with Mike McCarthy in Georgia during that time.
Well, let's go to the phone lines now and take a caller. Let's go to Essex Junction and talk with Chris. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Excellent, excellent topic. I just wanted to say I have two questions, and the first is why don't we simply ban phosphorus from products that could be then have the phosphorus go into the water system? I know we have a lot of low phosphorus detergents now, or no phosphorus detergents. Why is it necessary to have it in agricultural products at all? And my second question is, what other toxins are in Lake Champlain that make drinking the water questionable? Thank you. I'll take my answers off the air.
Thanks, Chris. Mike Winslow.
That's a really good question and involves an answer about what is phosphorus. Phosphorus is an element. It is essential to growth. It makes up parts of all of our bodies. And so you really can't ban an element. That said, we do want to limit the amount that comes into the watershed. And it's necessary for the growth of plants. So if there isn't enough available phosphorus in the soils, the plants will need it in order to grow. Unlike other fertilizers, nitrogen, phosphorus sticks around for a while. Nitrogen, if you just leave it alone, it volatilizes in the air. But it does become unavailable under certain conditions. So banning it isn't the greatest idea, but we do need to limit the amount that we bring into the watershed. We brought in 48,000 tons to Franklin County alone between 1924 and 2007. We've definitely been importing more than we've been exporting, and any of the excess ends up in the lake. We did try to get through to that through the legislature when we worked on the Clean Water Act to have a tax on phosphorus so that there was an incentive to not bring in – an additional incentive to not bring in as much. That proposal did not succeed in the legislature.
And I think – Chris had a second part to his question.
Was about other toxins.
Right.
In the lake. Drinking water in the lake meets all drinking water standards through EPA. In fact, EPA doesn't have standards for they've got tentative standards for some algae toxins, but I don't know of anything else in the lake that would be routine enough to be of concern. We do have occasional E. coli blooms, particularly following storms, but they tend to be very temporal. They're here and gone.
All right, let's take a call from John, who's checking in from Swanton. Hi, John. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. I have just a couple of comments as a 50-year part-time resident of the lake, primarily in the narrows between the Inland Sea and Missisquoi Bay. It was striking to me yesterday. I launch a boat the south end of Missisquoi Bay pretty regularly. And yesterday, the water quality had gone from pretty good to absolutely horrific. And I attribute that just to the runoff. The second thing is I think a lot of us that use and enjoy the lake a lot, are proud of it, are a little bit tired of what seems to be endless studies, but not a lot of action. And I guess I'd like to hear comments related to what we might expect for actions that will increase or make water quality better.
Well, the Clean Water Bill that was recently passed is in the stage where the rules are being written around it. It will affect municipalities that are trying that have to manage their roads. It will affect farms, as we discussed earlier in the program. There will be more limits on some wastewater facilities. There's consequences, more consequences for farmers who don't follow the RAPs. There's more streamlined enforcement of farm violations. There are a lot of things that will be happening, but my take, as I mentioned earlier, is that I expect these to prevent things from getting worse rather than actually changing the situation for the better.
And I want to go back to the point about the algae tracker. We got an email from Taylor wondering, are you confident that the public is always getting an alert within a day when algae blooms come up?
I'm confident they're getting an alert within a day. I'm less confident they're getting an alert within an hour. And again, there are a lot more bloom. There's potentially more blooms out there. We have 100 spots around the lake where we have these volunteer monitors going out on a routine basis. But there's a lot more area out there. I am confident that the public health is being protected because the consequences of being exposed to the blooms is fairly minor. And with some common sense, you can avoid it on your own. And one of the things that we've really tried to do with our program is train more people to recognize blooms and stay away from them. I think it's a mistake to depend on the government to tell you when it's safe to be exposed to algae or not. Just stay away from the green stuff.
So the message is, if you see it,
stay away.
Don't go in. All right, let's go back to the phones. We can get a couple more callers in. Let's go to Stratford and talk with Tim. Hey, Tim. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. So, my question is, I can remember back in the days when acid rain was a big issue, and there were measurements, I guess, of the quantity of acid rain that was landing in the lakes and ponds and around here and up in New York State, et cetera. And I'm wondering, whatever happened to acid rain, and also, more importantly, what else is coming out of the sky, and is it being measured with, to an eye on its potential effect on algae, et cetera, in the water quality in general.
Interesting question, Tim. So what about pollution that's coming from maybe rain and filtering from the sky?
Lake Champlain is less vulnerable to acid rain than many of the Adirondack lakes because of the bedrock. The bedrock can help neutralize the acid in a way the Adirondack lakes couldn't. Acid rain discharges have improved since the 1990s changes to the Clean Air Act. It's not my field of expertise, so I can't go too much into that beyond there. I don't know as much. The other thing that has come from the sky is mercury. We do get mercury deposition, although, again, that seems to have gotten a little bit better.
And finally, you've written about Lake Champlain and lakes in general having lifespans. And briefly, I'm kind of curious, where in the geological time frame of a lake's lifespan is Lake Champlain?
And it varies by segment. Missisquoi Bay is not long. From a geological perspective, Missisquoi Bay will be land fairly soon. The main lake is a much deeper, much more robust system that will last a long time. But that said, Missisquoi Bay has been even more shallow than it is now in the past, just with changes in the Earth's crust moving up and down from responding from the weight of glaciers. So short answer, it'll be here longer than any of us. geologists think at a different time span, but Missisquoi Bay is filling in.
Well, fascinating discussion today. Mike Winslow is staff scientist at the Lake Champlain Committee. That's a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Lake Champlain's health and accessibility. Mike, thanks a million for being on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, we'll tell you about a Brattleboro organization that's trying to convince more Vermonters to get around by bike, specifically cargo bike, to go to the store, to work, you name it. That's just ahead on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kekin for Jane Lindholm. There are a lot of things that Vermont takes the lead in, but mass transit is not one of them. Far too often when we need to make a run to the store for groceries or other goods, we hop in a car or truck. But wouldn't it be great to use your bike for a chore like that? If only your bike had the capacity to hold all those bags of stuff. Well, in Brattleboro, there's an organization working to get more people on electric-assisted cargo bikes to fill this need. Joining me now to talk about it is Dave Cohen. He's the founder and director of V-Bike. Dave Cohen, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Well, thanks, Nina.
So I know what a cargo van is and what cargo pants are, but tell me what a cargo bike is like.
Well, cargo bikes come in all shapes and sizes. The ones that we have are called long-tail cargo bikes. We also have mid-tail cargo bikes. The first half of it looks like a mountain bike. The last half of it looks like it's been extended out, like somebody stretched out the bike. And so it's got a large deck that passengers can sit on. It has running boards that you can put packages on. You can even tow a bike and tow a trailer, multitude of things you can do.
And so these bikes sound bigger and heavier than a traditional bike. How much heavier are they than a typical mountain bike?
Well, I've been riding cargo bikes for years, and these bikes are much lighter than their predecessors. And by the way, it's not just cargo bikes. We're looking at all kinds of designs and technologies that will help families, households, seniors, commuters, people with special needs with adaptive technologies and designs. So it really extends much further than the cargo bike idea, but that's one of the things that we promote, of course, for families and getting the children around.
Well, and to get people on bikes, I think sometimes we're daunted by the thought of a hill or carrying heavy loads up a hill. So I love the idea that these bikes have electric assist elements. Talk about the power element to these bikes. How does that work?
Yeah, electric assist is essentially supplemental power to give you and your body some assist. And so it really turns out to be the ultimate hybrid between human power and electric power. And so electric assist systems come in many different varieties, but most of them have different levels of assist that you can choose from. Level one would be very light, and then you can go all the way up to level five, which will give you maybe it'd be like three of you riding up a hill powering the bike.
So are you pedaling while the engine kicks in?
Oh, yeah, exactly. You want to be pedaling. A lot of them, a number of these bikes won't operate at all unless you're pedaling. And the battery itself, you'll really lose a lot of the capacity and the life of the battery if you're not pedaling. So pedaling is absolutely essential, I think, for electric cargo bikes and electric bikes in general.
When you're talking about a larger bike that has cargo capacity and some electric engine additions, how much do these bikes cost?
They range. So an electric assist system can cost starting around $500 all the way to $2,000. Cargo bikes, you can attach any one of these systems. Many of these systems can be placed on any bike, and those are called conversion kits. So you can convert a regular bike over for like $500, and it transforms your bike into something completely different. And your range, your carrying capacity, hill climbing ease, everything is radically transformed. And there are more expensive kits that could be had. But a cargo bike can start at around $1,000. So usually if family's outfitting a bike and we help them to do that, it'll run starting around $2,000 or so.
Well, and talk about your role and V-Bike's role in trying to get more Vermonters on these kinds of bikes.
Yeah, it's a thrill. And we call it rebooting the bike because the bicycle, and like our vision of the bike in Vermont, is so outdated. We're trying to get us to catch up with the rest of the world. And so Go Vermont, which is part of VTrans, it's essentially our state alternative transportation agency, really wonderful resource for Vermonters on all ends of transportation. They contracted with us to provide consultations to Vermonters and also to bike shops to really raise the level of what bike shops could do and also really give Vermonters a boost of information and all kinds of really good advice about, what to buy, what would be the right choice for their lifestyle, their terrain, and so forth.
So they can come in, sit down with you and say, I'm thinking about not buying a car and getting a cargo bike. Here are what my needs are. And you'll sit down and say, we think this might be the best model for you. And then don't you also let them try it out for a couple days?
Yeah, well, the consultations are a separate piece. We actually call that car reduction therapy. And that's a really important piece of what we do because, maybe folks out there are not going to believe us, but there are people emailing us and calling us and pleading with us. We really want to get out of the car. We don't want to be driving our kids around anymore. And so we provide those consultations, email, phone. The in-person thing, and as far as taking out a bike, that's a program that V-Bike runs, and that's called Take It Home. And that's just right now in the Brattleboro area. We're hoping to move that all around Vermont. But we have a fleet of bikes that folks can take out and for a period of like 3 or 4 days. Some people have taken out one for a week. Most of those people have actually turned around and bought a bike from one of the shops in Brattleboro, which I might add, the shops in Brattleboro have really taken up the mantle of this bike revolution.
So, Dave, how many people in the Brattleboro area are using these cargo bikes?
We're estimating right now there are, as far as cargo bikes, there's about 15. We're hoping by the end of the summer there could be 20. But there are at least 75 electric assist bikes moving around Brattleboro, including the cargo bikes. And next year we're really looking at doubling that, maybe even passing the 200 mark.
And last question, very briefly, what's the biggest obstacle?
Biggest obstacle is what my son would call, obstacle illusions. You know about optical illusions, but the obstacle illusions are all the fear that we have about the world that we've created and that it's unsafe because from the window of an automobile, everything looks dangerous or, you know, you fear what we're actually co-creating.
So it's just overcoming that initial mindset and jumping into switch.
Yeah. And we help people with that, too. We're going to be organizing rides in Brattleboro. And also Local Motion does this sort of work, too, which is a statewide organization.
I'm going to have to jump in and wrap this up. We're out of time, but I want to thank you very much. Dave Cohen is the founder and director of V-Bikes. Thanks for being on the program.
Oh, thanks, Naya.
And listeners, we have photos of V-Bikes on our website, vpr.net. Weekly installment of Summer School. First time Michelle Cunningham sold her homemade donuts at the Burlington Farmers Market, she made too few. After selling out before noon, she realized there was a market in Vermont for high-quality donuts made from local ingredients. Now Cunningham's business, The Donut Dilemma, has grown beyond the farmers market to a brick-and-mortar donut shop on Burlington's Main Street. Today, we're going to The Donut Dilemma to find out how they're made.
I'm Michael Mimbrino, and I'm a donut maker at The Donut Dilemma.
Bread flour, pastry flour, milk powder, which is just dried milk, sugar, salt, a little bit of baking powder, and then some potato starch, which helps them hold on to moisture, increases shelf life a little bit. And then we have eggs and water. I'm getting the butter ready because I only have about a minute or 2 minutes to add it once I start the mixing process. And there's, you know, four and a half sticks of butter here. So I have to cut some of it ahead of time.
I'm Michelle Cunningham. I'm the owner of The Donut Dilemma.
So I'm about to add the flour, or the dry mix that has the flour, the yeast, salt, other things, into this giant mixer. All right, so now I'm starting the mixer. So now it's kind of turned into a shaggy mess, and so this is just kneading it as you go. I can't imagine doing all this by hand. I just kicked up my mixer to a higher rate. It's gonna knead this a little bit faster. Start developing the gluten structure. When I'm teaching my staff about gluten structure, I talk about bubble gum. If you've ever chewed gum, when you first try to blow a bubble, when you first put that piece of gum in your mouth, it pops really quickly. But we want to work this dough just like we would work the gum, and then eventually you can blow really big bubbles. It's the same type of process. So the sound you're hearing is the dough actually slapping against the bowl. If I were making this at home and I just wanted the process all together, I would do a 30-minute rise. I would fold it, and then it
let it rise for another 30 minutes. But I would want the temperature to be closer to 80 degrees versus 75 or 77 because I want it to rise quickly. And then I would roll it out after that second rise
and let it sit for about 10 minutes after I rolled it out just to relax. Because that gluten, it's all stretched out. So if you try to cut the donuts right away, again, they'll still taste fine, but they'll shrink quite a bit. So we want to let them relax. When we made the donuts on my house, we actually bought fryers on Amazon. They were like $100, and they were definite workhorses. However, you could use just a pot with a little bit of oil in the bottom. To make a donut is actually really easy, but making a really good donut is really hard.
Once the dough is cut, Cunningham says it should be deep fried for about a minute on each side. The final product will stay fresh all day, but keep in mind that Cunningham refuses to eat a donut that's more than 20 minutes old. Today's segment was produced by VPR's Annie Russell. I'm hungry. I want a donut. That brings us to the close of today's show. Tomorrow, how do you surf the web? Most of us don't think about that, but what if you have a disability that doesn't allow you to see the content or hear audio clips? How would you navigate a website if you're not able to use a mouse? Just like a bricks and mortar business, websites need to be able to serve those with disabilities. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the digital compliance regulations that are part of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we'll hear from some Vermont companies that are working to provide solutions. I hope you'll join us for that tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Gene Murphy. Liam Connors directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.